got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. So good to be here with you and with Kevin. Kevin, what's up?
And very nice to be with you every week. And a couple things. If I've sound out of breath, is because I was chasing a chicken around my house.
Well, who doesn't do that on an afternoon?
Well, that was my dumb dog figured out how to open the door. And so now it's like, you know, I mean, it's not trivial. So the dog knows how to open the door and I'm walking around the house and there's chicken poop on the floor. And I went to get a beverage right before we start and there's like chicken dookies. And so I'm walking around seeing a chicken turd, chicken turd, chicken. And where's the chicken? And I walk into my bathroom, like this little bathroom in the back of the house. And there it is, smiling at me. A stupid little dinosaur. And then I tried to grab her and then ended up chasing her around the kitchen island because every time I would go to grab her, she would run the other direction. It was total comedy. It wasn't that funny. And I got her and I put her outside. But anyway, and the funny thing is her name is Poopsie. Why I couldn't named her Discipline is, but one interesting thought is that we did have a number of comments on last week's episode, one of which from Charles, who pointed out that in the article about the activist group that dumped the grain, that we said it was corn. The activist group thought it was soy and that it actually was wheat. And I think we reported it as corn and wheat or something. There just was some inconsistency there. And it turns out that I see what happened, that I was looking on different sources and different sources reported it differently. But also we reported it as 1,500 tons. No, it was actually reported as 1,500 tons. We said at some point 15,000 tons. So we're off by a factor of 10. In our reported tonnage. So just to make it real, thank you very much for keeping us straight. And we will correct the atrocity by a factor of 10.
Yes, we are. We're genuinely sorry. Thank you, Charles, for the correction. The scumbags at Greenpeace only dumped 1,500 tons of wheat during outbreak of a potential world war and a global food shortage. So that's our bad.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I do appreciate the corrections. Continue to send them. Yes. We also love the positive feedback. I heard from somebody this week, got an email out of the blue from someone with credentials in the topics we talk about. And she just said, "Hey, I love what you guys are doing." So yeah, reach out to us. We love being corrected. And we also love having our egos stroked. So,
You know what? Another one just to add to that ego stroking thing is that someone actually said, it's really funny. So we don't necessarily try to be funny. And we try to keep it interesting and maybe humor is an element of that. But someone said, no, it's the funniest thing they listen to and they laugh out loud every week. And I thought, well, okay, best seek psychological assistance. There are diseases where you do that. but I thought that was very nice. And so thank you for all the feedback and thank you for listening and for referring it to friends, because this is a product of the Genetic Literacy Project, they're the ones who, that it really is to support the efforts of Genetic Literacy Project, I don't receive a paycheck for this. I do this because I appreciate what they do and the fact that they try so hard to bring science to the public in a consistent way. And I love to support their mission. It's kind of the way that I can make a donation that's a little bit better than dollars to Genetic Literacy Project, but urge you to support them because it is all grant funded, depending despite what you may read online. 100% done by grants and other small dollars here and there, donations here and there. So there's my 2 cents for today.
Yeah, that's great. I'll just add briefly before we get into our stories. This is the kind of conversation you want society-wide. You want scientists like Kevin who have every justification in the world to hide away in their labs and in their classrooms and just do their academic work. You want them out engaging with people like me who are curious and have questions and have opinions but want to have informed opinions, you know? So this is sort of a model of what we want lots of people to be doing because the world will be a better place. So with that, let's jump into our stories and practice what we preach, as it were. So first up, do artificial sweeteners fuel cancer? New data reignites the debate. Next up, baseball's COVID problem. Unvaccinated players won't be allowed in Canada to play against the Blue Jays. And finally, is high cholesterol a red alarm? It's time to reassess the meaning of blood lipid levels. All great stories, Kevin, all very meaty. Let's start with this artificial sweetener study. What are we talking about here?
Well, the title of the article is Do Artificial Sweeteners Fuel Cancer? By Rich Haridi, New Atlas. And the answer is no. Let's move on. It's really funny because this actually was based on a study that was published in PLOS Medicine, I believe. And it was a cohort study, which means they take a group of people and they say, okay, starting at this baseline, we have this group of people that are similar in many ways, and we're going to follow you going forward. And we're going to see at the end of that time where we are. In terms of your, and this is in France, the cohort goes forward and they study what they were eating. They were monitoring their diet on a very high resolution basis, but occasionally. So you take sample days every month and talk about what you ate and how much you ate and what was in there. And what they ended up finding in this study was that the authors concluded that people who consumed aspartame and I don't know that this one's in the U.S. Acesulfame or acesulfame, K with potassium. When you consume these, that it associates with higher cancer risk. So what does that mean? All right, so you're consuming this stuff in beverages or whatever it is, and the people who did that tended to have more cancer incidence. And this is in a large study with, you know, reasonable statistical power. And so the question really is, okay, you see this association, but is it causal? And there's been so much work done on this going back a long way. When you look at back to the, you know, 50s and 60s, when things like cyclamates and other artificial sweeteners, these are compounds that interfere with the sweet receptors on the tongue and give the perception of sugar in the absence of sugar. So artificial sweeteners have been implemented by companies which wish to decrease the caloric compound, but also the glycemic index that can spike insulin levels and other stuff to enrich the sweetness or sweet perception of specific food products. And so this has been a real find that now is kind of spurring the authors suggest that the European food safety authorities should reevaluate the role of artificial sweeteners and their potential risk for cancer. But as you probably read, there's some problems with the study. So, you know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Let me get my checklist out. Okay. So, there's so much wrong with this paper, and I'm going to refer people to an article my colleague, Dr. Josh Bloom, wrote about this study. Here's the title of it. If you just Google this, you'll find it. French artificial sweetener cancer study is Les Bull Sweet. So let me go through. I'm not going to belabor any of these, but I'm just going to throw these out there and then you can weigh in on these as the scientist. So first of all, the new Atlas article, what they point out is if you take these numbers at face value, they say, and here's the quote, consumption of artificial sweeteners increased a person's relative risk of developing cancer by 13%. Yeah. But if you actually look at that in real numbers, it's 3 new cases of cancer in every 10,000 people over an 8-year period. So, so even if you take these numbers at face value, which you should not do, as I'll explain, it's a very, very small, risk factor, right? Consuming these. But let me go through a couple other problems I had with this study. The first is, as you said, these are self-reported numbers. People are saying, I had, you know, so and so many ounces of chocolate cake or whatever, right? But you don't know the nutrient content in those foods. You have to go look them up. So the European Food Safety Authority has a database that says, you know, a serving of this food has this many calories, this many gram of carbohydrate, so on and so forth. So they're comparing what people claim to have eaten against the numbers in a database. And if the food wasn't in a database, they had to perform a test that would give them the nutrient content of the food. So in some cases, they're estimating what people say compared to a test that they ran for this study. So you have these big gaps in how the data are collected. So that's very concerning. And let me stop there. I have a few other points, but stop there. Tell me what you think of that.
Well, that part is, I thought that was a minimal concern. in the panoply of different concerns of this paper, that was, you know, probably the thing that I looked at least. And really the big one for me is that who's choosing to consume artificial sweeteners? And it's people who say, okay, for some reason in my lifestyle, something's going on where low calorie sweeteners may be important. And some people just may not like a lot of sweetness, like me. I don't like that. I don't like something in sugar. It's like drinking syrup. So I like to take a can of diet soda and then dilute it with water or vodka. And so I try to keep it, you know, I try to dilute out the flavor. All of it's too sweet and syrupy. But the majority of people who are choosing artificial sweeteners already have some underlying health conditions, either diabetes or potentially obesity. And so what they found in the study was that the relationship was to breast and obesity related cancers. And so, people who are more likely to choose a artificial sweetener, a non-caloric artificial sweetener, are probably people who are watching calories because of interests in controlling weight. And so you automatically change the dynamics of this to, you know, are there already comorbidities that are associated with the consumption of diet beverages more than diet beverages are associated with cancer? Because even the risk that you talk about was tiny, and then you overlay comorbidities on top of that, and it really makes them really insignificant.
100%. My only point was the data going into all of the modeling is probably unreliable. And we know that because people lie about their church attendance. They lie about how much alcohol they drink. As we've discussed before, they lie about how much they eat to the point that they would be dead if they ate as little as they said they did. people lie about everything in epidemiological studies. Maybe sometimes it's misremembering, it's not with intention. But the point is the data is not reliable. But we can go further. Let's finish taking the study's lunch money, because there's some bad in here. So these are quotes from Dr. Bloom's article. I highly recommend that you read this. But he says, in the minimally adjusted data, higher consumers of artificial sweeteners actually have a lower chance of cancer than lower consumers. And then he gives the statistics. So these are actually in, if you go to table 2 of the paper, you can see this. And there were several other examples of this, where people who consumed either total sweeteners or they consumed more of one sweetener had fewer cases of cancer in their cohort. And the only way to get rid of this is to do some statistical footwork and say, well, you know, There's another variable that counts for some of this, and therefore you can still, keep the association intact. But this is one thing I would always encourage people to do is when you look at these studies or you see headlines related to them in your Google News feed or whatever, just go look at the tables in the study. Even if you don't understand the statistics, you can understand the basic numbers. So if people with the exposure in question have less of the disease in question, that should be your first clue that you're looking at something that probably isn't reliable.
Yeah, that's really an important point. This idea in scientific literature, we always refer to as dose response, that if putting in one unit of dose gives you X amount of response, you should see two units of dose give you two units of response, and maybe 100 units of dose giving you 100 units of response, to a point where that kind of plateaus, and you put in 1,000 units of dose, you still get 100 units of response because the system can't respond more. But there's this relationship that's very consistent among biological systems that gives you what we always think of as a dose response relationship. The more of it you, if it is causal, the more you consume, the more response you should see. And at least see that through some sort of linear range at some point. And so when you start to see a breakdown of dose response relationships, like, okay, we say artificial sweeteners cause cancer. So if the people who had a little bit got a lot of cancer, the people who ate a lot of it got a little bit of cancer, you can almost say that more of it is preventative. You know, and that was the old thing with the Seralini study too, you know, that the rats that ate, the male rats that ate a lot of glyphosate lived longer. But this is the point about dose response is that when you see, and this is the other thing when you're reading papers, when you see a breakdown in dose response relationships, you see a lot of what we refer to as hand waving. That scientists will start to say, well, we can explain that because of a non-monotonic response. You know, they start giving a some sort of other confounding variable that, you know, does occasionally happen, but hasn't been proven. It turns into another hypothesis to test rather than, well, the data just aren't that good. And there's other more simple reasons why we shouldn't make that final conclusion.
Here's just two other points I want to make very quickly, and then we can move on. But this is another quote from Josh Bloom's article. So he says, the incidence of cancer is unaffected by total consumption of artificial sweeteners. And then for, acesulfame? How do you pronounce that?
Since the one is aspartame, I go with the other one as sulfame potassium.
Okay.
And that one, you know, there's a couple of brand names in Europe. I don't know if that's one that we consume in the US. It may be. I really lost track of my artificial sweeteners. But the ones that really are doing, you know, aspartame seems to do okay, sucralose, all these things that they have. And all of these are just, you know, mimics of sucrose with respect to the tongue. But anyway, I guess that's how you pronounce it.
Okay. So overall consumption does not affect your risk of cancer. But then for this specific sweetener, Josh reported, it seems to be protective against breast cancer since the high consumers are slightly less likely to develop breast cancer in both the minimally adjusted and fully adjusted groups. So the numbers are all over the place, as you just said. But then here's the final point. And Josh is a chemist, so this is why he was annoyed at this. These are different chemicals. They have different properties. And so to group them all together and to suggest that they all contribute in some way to cancer without actually showing it and the mechanism by which it would happen, it's dubious. It really doesn't make any sense. And, there should have been more attention paid to that. But I'm done. I think we can conclusively say this. As the kids say these days, this study is Garbo.
Greta Garbo. That's what the old people say.
Yeah, I mean, because Garbo and garbage are the same length. You don't save any syllables, but I don't know. But my younger brothers, they say, that's Garbo, bro. So.
All right.
In any case, let's move on and talk about vaccine mandates in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, here's another one we can throw in the rebo. So Major League Baseball, this is kind of funny because this goes in the oops, we never could have anticipated this one problem. This is by Jared Diamond. I sat there and thought, Jared Diamond, why do I know that name? And he's the guy who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel. And so Jared Diamond, and then I thought, if the hockey players got locked out, it may have been by Jared Icerink. But anyway, baseball COVID problem, unvaccinated players won't be allowed to Canada to play against the Toronto Blue Jays. And the first thing that I thought was, all right, what about the Montreal Expos? But I don't think they're a team anymore. And so I found out that they're not. I mean, I'm so out of touch with respect to baseball. I used to love playing. I still love a good softball game. But Major League Baseball, I've been so tuned out. And mostly because of things like this. And really what's going on is that there was a significant pushback in Major League Baseball against COVID vaccines. And it turns out that a significant number of players still are not vaccinated. It's gotten better. There was a big breakout on the Boston Red Sox a few years ago, well, a year ago, whenever it was. And it turns out that the Canadian border has a very strong restriction as to who it lets through. And you have to be vaccinated in order to enter the country. And so, that's that, you know, these baseball players who are planning on playing in Toronto won't be let in. And the funny part about all this is that they just came up to a new labor policy a few weeks ago where they're not even going to get paid for the missed games. So it's not like there's a, you know, bonus to sitting at home. But the big sad part about this is that with baseball, even though you play 162 really long, boring games in a very laborious season, a game or two can make a difference in whether or not you make the playoffs. And so this kind of, I'm not getting vaccinated, I refuse to do it, now is paying dividends against those players and really hurts the entire team. And it just is another example of the anti-vax rhetoric having impacts well beyond just people not getting vaccinated.
I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach to this. I think this policy is actually nonsensical, frankly. I just don't think it's necessary anymore. And let me read you a quote. This is from an article. It was just published in the Journal of Infectious Disease. And it says, we now have a high degree of background population immunity to SARS-CoV-2, as well as medical countermeasures such as the antiviral drugs that we've talked about, Kevin, and then monoclonal antibodies. And then widely available diagnostic tests. So they conclude COVID-19 control is already within our grasp. Now that's not to be all dramatic here. That's Dr. Tony Fauci. So yeah. This is like, if there's anyone who is an authority on COVID-19, it's this guy. So basically what I'm taking from this is we have enough immunity in the population, either from infection or from vaccination, because it's close to 70% of the U.S. population is now vaccinated. So all I'm getting at is this mandate, it seems sort of nonsensical to try and enforce right now. I don't understand what the thinking is here.
Yeah, they're a little slow on the draw and dialing this stuff down. But, you know, that may be a Canadian thing. You know, I understand where they're coming from. Their government's been a little bit more proactive in enforcing mandates and other rules. There's been a lot of pushback against it too. I understand where they're coming from and why they're doing it. They're a relatively small, concentrated population on the border of within so many miles of the U.S. border. And, you know, disease travels fast and they have a healthcare system that is potentially very good, but also would, they can't have it get inundated like other ones can. So there's a lot of factors here that are confounding. And you know, the other thought that no one really maybe thought about was, since there's only one baseball team in Toronto, maybe that's what the whole basis for the whole, or in Canada, maybe that's the basis for the whole thing to get the World Series back to Canada. Is if you exclude all the other teams by making their good players who are not vaccinated stay out, you kind of skew the wins and losses towards Toronto. Does that make any, I know it's a harebrained conspiracy, isn't it?
No, I get it. I get what you're saying. I wouldn't put it past, you know, the MLB or even governments to go, you know what we could do is we could just ruin their chances at a championship and force them to get the shots. I'm just saying from a public health perspective, it's pretty clear now. The vaccines are still effective in terms of reducing your risk of severe disease and death, but they don't stop transmission anymore just because of Omicron and the subvariants. They've just mutated to the point where they don't stop transmission. That's not really controversial anymore. So I just don't see the logic of this. And then of course, baseball teams travel. So like there's a similar mandate in New York. I think they finally rescinded it or they're about to. So you had a situation even with basketball too, where like you had certain players that were unvaccinated. They could sit on the bench with their teammates and they could travel with their teammates and they could play in other places around the country. But when they came to New York, they could not actually participate in the game. So in terms of actually reducing the transmission of SARS-CoV-2, it's not doing anything. It's just more, I'm going to enforce this policy because I said so and I'm in charge. I think there's a little bit of inertia in that sense when it comes to public policy, where it becomes law or it becomes policy. And then we just go, well, the policy says this, so we've got to do it. And there isn't any, I guess there isn't much thinking in real time. Like, as you said, it's too slow to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, we're still wearing masks on planes and all that good stuff. Finally, at my university, we kind of are out of that. I don't know if we should be, it's such an easy thing to do to prevent something if there was a problem. The problem is with all of this is that if we do somehow spawn a variant that is more aggressive, more transmissible, that has a more fatal edge to it and evades vaccine surveillance, you know, what we already have, it's going to have quite a death toll because most people are so over this that, you know, they just don't care anymore. And it's going to be a real bad wake-up call. So hopefully we don't get to that. But I think things like this and other aspects, the differences between, you know, US and Canada, and in Canada, you know, I love Canada, but it tends to swing a little bit with what we do because it's our neighbor and so much commerce happens between the countries that they tend to do what we do only a little bit slower. My guess is, except for some things that they do really well, like put gravy on French fries. They nailed that one before we did. But they probably will change this policy before long. So, you know, I hope so. I really don't care about baseball, but I do care about the perception. And just to make this look like playing into that authority hand, you know, is really a sad thing. And it just shows that someone's got no balls and three strikes.
Hey, just a passing thought. Baseball games, by and large, are played outdoors. So
that's true.
So, you know, as has been well established, the risk of transmission outdoors is, it's not zero, but it's quite close to zero. To the point that,
yes,
you know, it's your, anyways, I won't belabor it. I've said what I need to say. Let's talk about this new understanding we're developing of cholesterol, Kevin.
Well, it's a new understanding, but maybe a new lack of understanding. And some of the things that we used to think were true are maybe turning out not to carry the gravity that they used to. And really the question, this was presented by Juan Revenga Frauca in La Paz. Is high cholesterol a red alarm? It's time to reassess the meaning of blood lipid levels. And cholesterol is an interesting thing because cholesterol is necessary for life. It's part of membranes. It's the stuff that your body uses to as the basis of a number of different steroid hormones. So, you know, whether you're talking about testosterone or aldosterone, whatever, progesterone, all this stuff is coming through from a cholesterol backbone. It's the basis of vitamin D and a whole bunch of other goodies. So, and your brain's loaded with it. Your brain, spinal cord, massive amounts of cholesterol. That's why when you eat a brain, it tastes real creamy. It's all that cholesterol goo that's in there. And I've never eaten a brain. Have you eaten a brain?
I've been trying to cut back. You know, it's a little too rich for my
taste. Little rich for your blood. Yeah. It's allegedly, like, some people who love it, they get sesos and they love it, but I'm kind of freaked out by prion disorder. So I stay away from central nervous system tissue. But anyway, the idea is that the brain is loaded with cholesterol, and cholesterol comes from two places. Your body makes it because your body needs it. At the same time, you also get it from foods you take in, namely meat, dairy, milk, that kind of thing, eggs. You know, you bring the cholesterol in. And so something like 80-90% is self-manufactured. The rest is dietary. And years ago, it's going back into the 60s, people started to look at how the relationship between fatty foods and heart disease would correlate. And I remember, I don't know exactly where this came from, but there were old studies that were very famous that studied this. And there were studies, of course, looking at the coronary arteries of soldiers who died in war in the Americans versus, say, the Vietnamese, and seeing tremendous differences even in young men who had died in the battlefield, and that there was a lot of coronary heart disease that at least was beginning. And so there was a lot of the discussion around this had come from the correlations of heart disease and hyperlipidemia. And so this idea of high triglyceride levels, high cholesterol levels, people started to look at this as a correlation that made some pretty good conclusions. And so when the idea of statins came along, and these were compounds that would decrease the amount of soluble cholesterol, these were prescribed for people who had very high cholesterol levels. The problem was that there were people out there, and they're talking about high cholesterol is above 200 milligrams per deciliter. Mine's always at 225. And doctors have said, you got to get on statins. I don't want to take any more. I make 225 because that's how much I need. You know, I have testosterone and a big brain to keep going. you know, I mean, maybe I need a little more, you know, a little bump. You know, I don't know. But there are people who have cholesterol levels that are above 1,000, you know, some families in Italy and other places, and zero heart disease. So it seems like that's not exactly an exact correlation. What it really seems to be more of a correlation with is what your body does with that cholesterol. And so the question of genetic differences that control LDL, which is low density lipoprotein, which attracts cholesterol in some ways, versus a high density lipoprotein, which actually removes cholesterol, those things tend to be probably better indicators than cholesterol levels itself. So like the first story where we talked about, you know, cancer rates and the relationship to artificial sweeteners, here we're looking at cholesterol and heart disease, maybe through a slightly different lens after time.
I think the primary study you had in mind was Ancel Keys' seven country yes. study.
That's and it. Thank
he,
you.
He was a researcher at the University of Minnesota in the 1950s and 60s, I believe. And he got all kinds of awards and attention. He was on the cover of Time magazine, I want to say, for this research. And then it was later reported that he basically excluded every country that didn't follow the association. So there are a lot of countries where saturated fat consumption was high and heart disease was low. So this came out later, and it was clear that it was more complicated. But I think what still kind of bugs me, even about this article we're discussing, is they say that, or the author says, you know, cholesterol isn't what we thought it was in terms of its significance to your health. But at the end of the article, it says the key ingredients to a healthy diet are fruits, vegetables, legumes, nuts, whole grains, fish, low-fat dairy products, and vegetable oils. That's been the nutrition advice for, I don't know, 50, 60 years. And there's much better research now. And let me look at a couple of things. These are from two studies, and I'll link to these if people want to know. But there's clinical trials that have been done. They show that eating saturated fat, like high levels, maybe like 40, 50% of your diet, it boosts your HDL levels. And it either slightly reduces your LDL or it leaves it unaffected. But the more important thing is that it shifts the pattern of the particle size from the small dense ones that can get stuck in your arteries to these lighter fluffy ones that don't. So in other words, even though we're like very slowly recognizing that high cholesterol by itself is not bad, we're still enforcing the same, or we're still pushing the same dietary advice that we've had for years that we know is not correct anymore. And I just find that interesting. It's almost, I don't want to say religious because that's a little too strong, but it is this sort of faith-based, like, yeah, cholesterol is not bad. Also eat a plant-based diet and cut fat, you know, fatty dairy out of your diet. It's like, why? I don't understand why these two things are allowed to stay together. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, it kind of falls in the category of wooden hoit and all the other stuff that comes along with eating a plant-based diet, all the micronutrients and other weirdnesses that come along that are actually a benefit. And of course, the high fiber and other things which benefit other aspects of health, not just circulatory health. But, you know, there's so many nuances to this conversation. And I think that's what's really unfolding here is that when you start looking at the medical literature, which I started diving into a little bit around this, and I basically got, you know, went down 100 rabbit holes and found 100 different rabbits, is that you start to look at seeing positive effects among specific cohorts. So if you have an elderly population that has had heart disease, you see positive benefits of statins and ways in which they have very good effects on longevity and further heart disease complications. It also depends on what kind of statin you're using. So there's all kinds of statins are a broad class of drugs. So if you're using Torvastatin or whether you're using that or simvastatin or whatever, there's different statins that you're using, which have different effects and different effects on different lipids. And ultimately on the physiology of people in hyperlipidemia situations. So it really, really varies between all these other nuances. And whether you're talking about old patients and young patients, people with high cholesterol versus sky high cholesterol versus high HDL and low HDL or high LDL or the ratio between the two, what the basic point is, you have to kind of go with that moderation thing because the data continue to get more confusing and confounding with time. And I started looking at all the studies on eggs and everybody used to say, remember, eat an egg a week or else you're going to die. Now it's, there's nothing wrong with eggs. So it's all up in the air. And, you know, the best thing you can do is have a good time all the time. Moderation.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think the more important point is that like the macronutrient composition of your diet matters. And as you just said, it's going to vary depending on, you know, all the variables that apply to you directly. No doubt about that. But I think the point is that you shouldn't be sitting in your house eating a mountain of soy products and you shouldn't be eating 4 steaks for dinner and nothing else, you know, the all meat thing that Jordan Peterson's all about or whatever, like, like these extremes are unnecessary. That's the only point. So if you if there's certain things you prefer eating and you can maintain a, you know, reasonable diet and you're in good shape and you're healthy and all that, then by all means, you know, it's just the extremes are what I find so strange in all of this. And I have to admit, I do have a little bias because I lost the weight, my excess weight on a low carb diet. And when I went into the doctor and they did my blood lipid panel before he got the results back, my doctor's like, you know, you should really cut back your saturated fat intake. It's, you know, these numbers are going to be kind of concerning. And then the numbers came back and they were perfect. He had no complaints. He's like, okay, well, I changed my mind, you know, just do what you're doing. Cause it's fine. So I guess the point is like, something that works really well for one person might not work for someone else. So it's instead of trying to be an evangelist for the Mediterranean diet or the Atkins diet, you know, do what works for you.
Yeah. And that's the most important point. I mean, when I was trying to lose weight, I was 235 pounds at one point in my life, like in the early 90s. I got real heavy. I couldn't even walk up four flights of stairs without being so winded. And I said, they got to change this stuff. And so plus I was completely broke. So I started eating just a vegetable diet and getting away from meats and stuff just because I couldn't afford it anyway. I just ate, I'd go to the local farm stand and just load up. And 16 years later, I really didn't want any meat products. I just, for 16 years, I just ate vegetables. And I'd still go to the doctor and they'd go, dude, your cholesterol is insane. It's like 225. Oh my God. And I go, well, 225, that's just a little bit outside of the normal zone. And it's consistently there. So maybe that's just what I need. You know, maybe that's just what, my body makes, because that's where I'm at. And they always said, yeah, but we're going to watch it. And here we are 25 years later, still watching it. And the beautiful part about all of this is that, you have to do what works for you. And everybody's different genetically. And all of these kind of cross the board dietary guru advices it's all garbage. You have to see what works for you. And probably the best diet advice that anybody can give you is get out and move. That seems to be the thing that in my mind's eye correlates with the biggest declines in health, especially as we age. The people who are sedentary are the ones who are in the worst, who are the ones who have the worst health. And even people who are heavy, who are walking constantly and are maybe going, walking 5 to 10 miles a day by their, watch, metabolically, they're maybe a little bit bigger and they maybe look a little pudgy, but they're still healthy. And I think that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. I think the best thing, again, this is just my preference, but lifting weights, I love it. And I think most people should do some kind of free weight, some kind of like heavy lifting or whatever you can manage. Cause it feels good. It sucks while you're doing it. I hate doing squats. They suck, but I can put on heavy metal in my headphones and I just go for it. And then I feel great afterwards. And you can sense the difference. Like when you're going about your day, if you have to lift something up or you go walking or you have to run or something, like you can feel that you're stronger and healthier. I'll stop now.
You're lifting heavy metal.
Dun, dun, dun.
Absolutely. No, but that's funny because I always love that feeling of, being sore from having exerted myself too much. And I loved, I used to love tearing it down. I was always in the gym pushing big, big weight. And I got out of that, basically because of injuries and perpetual injuries but now it's like, I look like crap and I got to get back to it. But for me, what I always loved was, and this was way before it was popular. Back when I used to practice martial arts a lot, we would start with kettlebells and that is a heck of a workout. And so I got to get back on that thing. And I keep saying, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get out into the barn and have at it. And, it really needs to happen because I'll tell you, there is nothing worse than becoming sedentary. And even in my life, sitting in front of a computer 8 hours a day, I got to get out. I can't wait to get out on the farm and dig a hole. So got to get a whole lot more of that.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It just feels good. I mean, I think we've talked, about the evolutionary biology of this, about how we were meant to be moving in some capacity, whether it's, chasing down, some animal you're going to eat, or you're running away from something that wants to eat you or whatever, that's not a thing anymore, but little bit of exercise feels good. I'm done, Kevin. Who are you following on Twitter?
I am following Keys Huizinga.
What a great name.
Oh, get out of here. Yeah, that's the closest. He's either a goalie in the NHL or an NPR reporter. One of those two. Keys Huizinga is here with a World Music Report. He goes by on Twitter a Dutch farmer in Ukraine. And he is a Dutch farmer who farms in Ukraine, and as the name implies, and he is a wealth of information right now during the Ukraine crisis and has a lot of relevant, pertinent information, especially towards wheat farming in that country. He is a farmer. He has a lot of great stuff online. He doesn't have a huge amount of followers, but he should have all the followers. So definitely check out at Dutch Farmer in UA. Who are you following, Cameron?
I'm following Tom Naughton, who he's a computer programmer by training, but about a decade ago, he made a documentary called Fathead. And it was a response to Morgan Spurlock's Super Size Me. And it's hilarious. It's really funny. It's well done. But there's also interviews with experts. He talks about the literature, about the lipid hypothesis, which we were just talking about. And he talks about obesity. It's really good. But he goes through and he basically says that Morgan Spurlock lied to you for an hour and a half about everything. So if you want to watch the documentary, I believe it's on YouTube. It's just called Fathead. It's on Amazon Prime as well. I don't know if he's blogging anymore, but he had a blog for years and he just went through these epidemiological studies about eggs and, you know, the benefits of whole grains and all that. And he just documented everything that was wrong with him. It was really informative. So follow him. It's at Tom D. Naughton and it's N-A-U-G-H-T-O-N.
Naughton.
Yeah. He's a good guy. I've interviewed him. It was years ago, but in any event, there you go. Follow both those individuals. Thank you as always for listening. We really appreciate it. Send us your comments, your questions. You can yell at us and call us stupid. That's fine too. And Kevin, thank you. I really enjoy these conversations, my friend.
Well, I look forward to it every we record on Friday afternoon. I really look forward to this every week. It really has become a high point. And just the fact that people have been commenting and really are engaged online, it really makes me excited to dig into these stories a little bit deeper every week than we used to. I don't know if you get the same thing. It's like I really put in a lot of time into prepping and thinking about this and really grateful for this opportunity. So thank you very much. And I think it's number 163 or something. So we're moving along.
163. We will be back next week for 164. Thank you so much.